Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report, and we are continuing our discussion on harvesting opportunities, a conference put on by American Farmland Trust this coming November 4th. We are joined on the line by John McDowell. John is the president of the Rockland Farm Alliance. John, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So, tell me, how did you get involved with the Farm Alliance?
Well, I'll try to make this story as short as possible. I first will say that I'm from Illinois. I grew up around farms, although I'm a composer and musician. My wife and I both ended up in Rockland and in the 90s, and just around 2003, we started the first CSA in Rockland County, Community Supported Agriculture. And what I discovered was that the mindset was either that farming is dead or, farming is just, there's no future for farming, et cetera. So, but the fact was that many people still remember the farms, and still there were some farms still left, and I felt like no one was really watching the ball, and of course, this is part of what the conference is about, is at least on my track, is the idea that farms don't have to be way off in the country. You know, they can be closer to metropolitan areas. And so there's all kinds of policy work we did, and it goes on and on. We've had grassroots meetings and got the Farmland Protection Board of the county back together. So it really was something that was an idea of its time. You know, as you know, people were not really geared up and excited about farming, local farming, 20 years ago or 15 years ago. So it was a perfect timing for this to happen.
So, yeah, the title of your panel is Farming in the City and the Country, Land, Economics, and Public Benefits. So tell me, you know, one of the challenges I see to farming in a less remote area or in a more urban environment is, my guess is you probably have to do a slightly different type of farming. You're not going to be running giant combines through town. So how do you see it as, like, is there a right type of farming for these type of spaces?
Well, right. We actually do drive tractors down Main Street, but we just, you know, I'm just kind of joking because it is congested, but we are in this in between area. This word is not really caught on, but peri-urban. So a lot of Rockland is still rural, but a lot of it is developed and kind of suburban-like. But it's an old county, like, you know, everything's old. But as far as the history of America, so there are the roots of a lot of farms. So to get to your question, We looked at what land was still available, what farms were still available, and what we happened upon was that the municipalities, whether they're the county itself, county government, or towns or villages, had open space that was protected or saved, but no one was thinking that it would go back into farmland, which, of course, it once was. There used to be 900 farms here, and it got down to about four, right around the time we started. So,
Wait. So 900 farms to 4 farms. Over kind of what time period are we talking about?
1930s till just 2001, 2002.
Wow.
And now we've gotten back up to 10, which we're really proud of and happy about. We've created 4 farms, and then I think I won't take credit for all of them, but I think that the mood of enthusiasm and support and we can do it sort of was infectious, and people, you know, just decided to go ahead and farm, whether they were on existing farmland or they could lease properties. And I'll just say that what I was starting to say before is that we happened upon this fact that these towns have open space, so we've organized these no-cost licenses or leases with municipalities. So it's a great kind of win-win situation where the municipalities don't have to maintain the land. They didn't know quite what to do with it. Usually they just let it grow back from fields to scrub to, you know, to little woods, and which is fine, but they were farms, and so we came along and said, let's keep this land farmed. So the big farm that we have now is Cropsey Farm, Cropsey Community Farm, and it's a 250-member PSA. And now the county is offering us more land, and also the Clarkstown, for example, has just offered us, well, we just signed a license with a 10-acre piece. So that's of course, with farming, that's the huge hurdle is land, is where access to land, and then of course buildings, and most of these properties not only have land but some buildings. So that was really a great way to get moving and on this.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about when we had David Haight on, the New York State Director of American Farmland Trust, was talking about land ownership versus leasing. And setting farmers up for success as far as investing in the infrastructure for their property and in the soil on their property. Have you guys been able to negotiate more long-term lease and arrangements when you're working with municipal property to make sure that, you know, as people get onto this land and work it and develop it, that they're going to be secure in the long term?
Right. And it's a good question, and it's a really good point. We do as much as we go as far as we can with the licenses. You know, some are longer than others. But, you do have a situation where some developer would say, well, you can have this land for a year, and, you know, they just don't get it, that how much, you know, not only labor, but expense of fencing and equipment it takes. And it takes a lot of work to move from one farm to another. It's not, you know, we're not just doing hay. And as you asked earlier, it is mostly vegetable production with some fruit. So it's you're setting up beds, you're working with this, you know, at least our methods of organic farming is to really work, improve the soil and all those things. So we get the licenses to go as long as we can. But my other philosophy is kind of build it and make it so beautiful that no one will ever want to change it, you know. And I think originally some of this land, if that would be put into a park or a soccer field, and we have plenty of parks in Rockland, which is, you'll have just a couple people, like somebody walking their dog or something. Now, I mean, kids are, it's, you know, unfortunately, inside much more than they used to be, and of course, that's one thing we're working on, getting so many school groups and kids to the farm. So, yeah, just a long answer to say we go as long as we can with the licenses, and like I said, build it, make it beautiful, and there's so much enthusiasm from the community that there would be really outrage if the next mayor or supervisor would want to change something. And the other thing I'll add quickly is that we do also farm private property. So that's, we have, you know, try to get long-term licenses or leases with private landowners.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is definitely a education process, and I love that strategy of just make it so nice that no one will even consider changing it. Well, I know that we are tight on time. I did want to just wind down with one final question. You are, an award-winning musician and composer, and I'm wondering if you could share with us how your work as a musician relates to your work as a farmer and an agrarian.
Oh, well, it's mentioned so much, and it's hard to answer that, but somehow they really they really relate. I think it's, you know, if you look at the, you know, the many tools you need or attributes to compose or play music or be a farmer, there's a lot of creativity and imagination and improvisational aspects as well. There's something so related, connected with the land and music, I would say, and, you know, creativity. So I remember the day I was sitting at the piano looking outside at our land and thinking, I've been sitting in this chair for 40 years, like practicing every day, and even, of course, I would go outside and take walks and things, but I just want to go, we're going to put this land into production and make a beautiful farm. So we actually have a group called Music for Farms, and so that's, we sometimes tour and go to farms and raise money for benefits and that sort of thing as well.
So lots of different ways that they're overlapping. Well, John, thank you so much for taking some time. If folks want to find out more about the Rockland Farm Alliance, they can find you at www.rocklandfarm.org. And can we sign up for CSA shares for the next season?
We're just starting that in, I think, the beginning of, I believe, December 1st. We're doing that, but you're welcome. People are welcome to send an email, ask questions. We're streamlining everything. You know, it's a great system, but it's, you know, it takes sort of kind of ownership from people to really understand it and work it out. We have had shares going to the city. We didn't do it last year because it was so popular here, but who knows? We may go again into the city. We'll see. So, yeah, please have everybody stay in touch, and let's work together on this. It's a big venture that's going across the whole country, and I think our model is, could work anywhere in the country.
Awesome, so John. Great to talk to you, too. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was enjoyable. Thank you.
Yeah, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be on the line with Walt Kiernan, a dairy farmer up in the Hudson Valley, to learn a little bit more about what you'll be expecting from him at the Harvesting Opportunities Conference coming up this November 4th in Albany, New York. Hang tight. We will be right back.
Won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Won't you save it? Oh, won't you save it all for me?
You're listening to Pumpkin Pie by the California Honey Drops.
Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam? Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Won't you save it? Oh, won't you save it all for me?
It's apple picking season. Join EscapeMaker.com and the New York Apple Association at the Union Square Green Market, Friday, September 18th and Friday, October 16th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the 2015 Apple Palooza Games. Go to the EscapeMaker.com pop-up booth for all your regional agritourism information and a chance to play apple-themed games like Giant Apple-themed Twister. You could win a bag of delicious apple cider donuts and fresh apple juice. Everyone will receive helpful information on where to go for pick your own apples this harvest season and a fresh apple grown in New York State. There's no better time to explore outside the city, soak up the fresh air and scenery like a butterfly, and support your local orchard. Log on to escapemaker.com to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
Okay, and we are back. You, of course, are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network, listening to the Farm Report. And in the second half of the show, we are joined on the line by Jerry Cosgrove to continue our conversation on harvesting opportunities in New York, conference put on by the American Farmland Trust up in Albany this November 4th. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here.
So you are taking part in a panel that's entitled Investing in Helping Farmers Find a Farm. So I guess we should start a little bit with your background. I mean, you actually come from a farming background. You grew up on a dairy farm up in Clinton, New York. And one of the stories I love so much from your bio is talking about showing your brother's cow at the International Dairy Show in Wisconsin. It says in your bio that you were more nervous that night than any other time in my life. So why were you so nervous?
Well, if you're a Holstein enthusiast, showing in Madison at the International Dairy Expo is the pinnacle of cattle showing, and was something I'd done growing up, and my brother allowed me to lead his prized cow, and I felt there was a lot riding on it. So it was a fun experience, but it was not quite rational how nervous I was, but I was.
Well, my big question was, why wasn't your brother showing his prized cow? Why did he pick you?
Two reasons. One, I think he knew it meant a lot to me to do it. And two, I don't think he would admit this, but I'm a better leads person.
So, you know, you left the farm to pursue a degree in agriculture from Cornell, and then you went on to pursue a law degree. Why the transition from agriculture to law? What prompted that?
Yeah, well, interestingly, what I actually, between getting my ag degree in law school, I farmed in partnership with my father and brother on the dairy farm. And candidly, I realized that the 24/7 routine of a dairy farm, wasn't physically sustainable for me. But as I looked for other opportunities, I naturally, from having grown up, being interested in history and politics, thought about law school. And it wasn't really till after I finished law school that I was able to find sort of the right combination, what I always call my sweet spot, at the intersection of agriculture, law, and conservation. And so for me, it's been, you know, a great opportunity to be able to combine both my agricultural experience and legal expertise to help farmers and help conserve farmland and provide access to land and transfer farms to the next generation, all critical issues.
Yeah, so now you run Jerry Cosgrove Consulting Services, and over your 30-year career, you've worked with a variety of organizations and in a variety of roles here in New York State, everything from private capital development to farm estate planning. And I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of a snapshot from where you sit at how we're doing now. Do you feel like we're in an optimistic space as it relates to keeping farmers on farmland and finding farms? Or are you worried? What's the level of kind of urgency and feelings around that?
Well, I think overall I'm optimistic and hopeful, and I'm that way by nature. But I do think that in the last 10 to 15 years, there has been a really significant and critical increased awareness from the general public about the importance of where their food comes from, that making the connection between food and farms and farmers and farmland. So I'm encouraged. I mean, there are a lot of challenges that remain. Agriculture is a tough, tough business. The margins are thin. It's high risk. You're at the mercy of Mother Nature. In New York State, and in particular in the Hudson Valley, we've got intense land development pressures. We've also got competition for land from non-farm buyers that drive the price up beyond the reach of what farmers can afford to pay for it. And I really feel strongly, having come from a family farm, that having access to land and being able to own it, or at least have the equivalent of ownership, is really critical for farmers. People who haven't been really closely connected to the land don't fully appreciate how significant and how strong that desire is on the part of farmers large and small, to own their land, own the land that they farm. It really does impact how they see it, and it's very important to them, and a strong driver for why they work so hard at what they do.
Well, so we have been chatting with some other folks who are going to be up at the conference about the importance of this idea of ownership, or I like the way you put it, equivalent of ownership. And I'm assuming what you mean there is kind of long-term lease arrangements. Is there something else that would be included in that equivalent of ownership space?
You know, I think long-term leases, if they're structured correctly, I mean, one of the challenges with most leases, and this is going to be, I'm sure, a significant topic of conversation at the conference and certainly in our session, is that, you know, when most people talk about a long-term lease, it's maybe 5 or 10 years. But I think in agriculture, you really need to think generationally. You know, farmers have careers of 20 or 30 years. I mean, that's the time horizon that they think about their land. And in fact, in many cases, farmers will make improvements knowing that they won't live to see the benefits of them. They'll plant trees, they'll plant, you know, sugar bushes, they'll make improvements in the land that there won't be a short-term payback, but they know it's the right thing to do. So we really have to extend the notion of long-term when we're thinking about leases. And again, I think there's a growing interest and willingness to think about how to do that.
So kind of on that note, because I know you do work around farm estate planning, when we, again, are thinking about like access to land and land value, if I'm a farmer, someone who's worked in agriculture for my whole life, and I'm ready to retire, and the most kind of valuable asset I have is my land and the infrastructure on it, but I want to ensure that that stays in farmland, can you talk a little bit about what are some of the challenges that come up in that space when you're looking to fund a retirement and also protect this thing that you've invested in? What are some of the directions that people go to support a retirement and to not remove the land from agriculture and farming?
Well, let me first say that you put your finger on one of what I would consider one of the largest challenges in the farm transfer area. The fact is that, you know, it's not an exaggeration to say that in most cases the farmer's land is his or her retirement. And so one of the challenges with that is that, you know, it's a very valuable asset. In some cases it may have a value beyond money that the farmer then needs to figure out how to use to support his or her retirement without liquidating the asset at its highest value, which, again, sadly, in many cases, is for something other than farming. That's just the way our market real estate system is set up.
Right.
So it creates a dilemma. And I think, historically, I think in family situations, many times the retiring generation would consciously gift much of the appreciated value to the next generation. They would essentially transfer, sell, or give the land at very close to its agricultural value. And that works in some contexts, but in other areas where you've got a farmer who's retiring and doesn't have the next generation in place, or perhaps has significant retirement income needs and they can't afford to make a gift even to their own family.
Mm-hmm.
Then the challenge is to find a way to generate liquidity, you know, translated means cash, so that the farmer can do both. And this is where we're, I think, very fortunate in New York State to have, thankfully now under the Cuomo administration, a very well-funded purchase of conservation easement or purchase of development rights program, which will compensate the farmers for that spread in value between its agricultural value and what, you know, a real estate developer would pay for it on the open market. And that those funds help the farmer to retire. They make the farm more affordable, and they conserve the farm. So it's a win-win-win. And, again, especially in the Hudson Valley, I can tell you that probably all of the clients that I'm currently working with in farm transfer scenarios, and these are within families and it's a couple situations where it's not among families, are being facilitated by the sale of development rights because it creates this funding source so that the retiring farmers can retire and the younger farmers can afford to buy the farm closer to an agricultural value. So it's a really, really important tool, I think. It was unfortunate that, you know, the program kind of went into hiatus between the Patterson and Cuomo administrations. But again, I think folks are all pleased that the Cuomo administration has begun, you know, making new requests for proposals. And certainly there's, you know, hopes that there will be a request for proposals imminently focused on the Hudson Valley with some of the bank settlement funding, which will, again, create tremendous opportunities to conserve land, to transfer farms, and to make them all affordable, more affordable.
Well, yeah, and I do feel like, you know, we were speaking with John McDowell from the Rockland Farm Alliance earlier in the program, and I was surprised to learn that in his region, you know, the number of farms had gone from somewhere, he said, in the 900 range in the 1930s, to around 5 in 2007, and they've been able to like bring that number back up to 10 here in 2015. But the change in this space in both like the number of farms, I feel like it happens really fast. So I do feel like there is an increasing sense of urgency, in particular when you're looking at different government kind of runs, like to me, I'm like, we can't really afford to miss these opportunities in between administrations, because there's chunks of farmers who are retiring and needing to retire all the time. So it's really, there needs to be at a grassroots level more pressure, it seems to me, put on people who are in decision making spaces to fund these type of programs, because no one is, you know, tearing down housing projects and strip malls to build farms, or is that happening somewhere that I don't know about?
Not that I know of, and I couldn't agree more that I think there needs to be consistent, regular funding. The demand always exceeds the available funds. Again, it's a great tool. It's one that's effective and fair to the landowner. Again, you know, landowners, this is their equity, so simply taking it away from them is not fair nor feasible.
Right.
So you've got to provide compensation. And again, the source of that, we've got great partners in the philanthropic, private funding community. But at the end of the day, it's a significant public benefit. And so there should be a significant public investment. And, you know, again, I'm sure that the advocates, including those folks at my former organization, American Farmland Trust, and I am in this group, you know, want to advocate for significantly increased funding moving forward, because you're right. The time is now, the need is there. There's an opportunity to secure this land before, you know, it gets developed in a wasteful fashion. You know, there's lots of land that could be developed, or especially in urban areas, redevelop.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop wasting the land with large lot development, McMansions in the middle of productive fields. I mean, we've all seen them. And if you're a farmer, you know, it really makes you want to throw up.
Yeah,
Because you see the big house with the big lawn in the middle of a big field that's essentially worse than a condo development. Because some of these big McMansions, They'll eat up 10, 15 acres at a time. And, I mean, talk about a waste of land. So we've got, you know, as you observe, there's a lot of work to do, and we need to stay with it and keep the focus and the pressure on.
I'm wondering if there is another space that it might be helpful for our listeners to draw a comparison. When we think about, because I feel like pushback I get sometimes from folks is like, well, you know, the market forces will determine things, and, you know, we shouldn't be spending, you know, public money to support individual farmers. And I think what's missing in that kind of line of analysis is all the spaces that we are consistently, as a country, through our public policy, deciding what things we kind of value and invest in and support. And I'm wondering if there is a parallel that jumps to the forefront of your mind of other areas where we have said from a policy perspective, we're like, we're going to support or undergird this sector of the economy or this type of development because it's important to our national identity.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a couple of levels. There's the notion of, securing and maintaining, a good food supply. There's the concept which many in the planning community have really drawn, likening farmland to part of the green infrastructure. You know, again, we pay for roads and the road improvements because we know we need that's public infrastructure. The fact is that while it's privately managed, our farmlands are really essentially public infrastructure from a food production perspective. And one of the advantages of purchasing development rights, purchasing conservation easements, is it's a public investment in keeping the land available to farm. I mean, those programs don't guarantee a profit to farmers. That's a related but separate issue.
Right.
What they do is they keep the land available so that the farmers can continue to run their operations and not have to worry about, higher property taxes or development that's inappropriate, impinging their farming operations. And frankly, it creates a better mechanism and avenue to transfer the land to the next generation when that becomes necessary or appropriate, because the development option is taken off the table, and with good land, it should be. So I think I agree that the market analogies are really not appropriate. I think that folks are being short-sighted if they think about land as a commodity like others. It's really not.
It's really
limited.
Not.
There's better land that should be conserved for agriculture. And I think, people need to recognize that this is important for the long-term sustainability of our food production. And, one of the things that I really hammer to the sustainable agriculture community is that they need to understand that the foundation for sustainable agriculture is the land. And you can talk all you want about sustainable agricultural practices, but if the land is developed, you never even have that conversation. It's moot. So I think the sustainable ag community is coming around and recognizing that conserving the farmland is really fundamental, basic, and important, and unfortunately, expensive.
Yeah.
Because we've got a real estate system where there's a non-farm development value. In the Hudson Valley, there's an estate value that you have to compensate the landowners for. That's our system. So it's somebody's got to make that investment, be it the government, philanthropy, or in some cases the individual landowners themselves. And we need all of those sources of support. It's not just going to be one or the other carrying it forward.
Well, because we are all eaters, none of us
right.
get
Again,
to sit that one out.
Sort of where I started. I am encouraged that more and more people are getting that, and they start to understand the link between the farmland, the farming, the farmer, and the food.
I had, this is kind of jumping back to a little bit earlier when we were talking about retirement, but we do hear a lot about, an increasing percentage of America's farmers are going to be retiring over the course of the next, decade. And the percentages and the time frame shifts and changes a little bit. But I'm kind of curious about retirement more generally. you know, I feel like as lifespans are getting longer and people are living, you know, people are just actually living much longer. Is there a culture, like what is the retirement culture in agriculture? You know, I mean, do we like look hard and fast at that 65 kind of cutoff, or is it something that, you know, is more of a sloping removal, or I guess I'm just from like a quantitative standpoint, like is retirement for farmers inherently different from like an age and workforce perspective than for, you know, other occupations, if you know?
I think fundamentally, yes. And there's really two elements, and I think they need to be thought about separately. There's the work of farming. And I'll use my father as an example. He loved farming. And when he, quote, retired, he still worked 40 to 50 hours a week for my brother. Because there was nothing he'd rather do. He liked golf. He liked travel. But he loved farming, and he kept doing it. So many farmers, if they're physically able, will keep farming as long as they can. And in many families, what you see is the senior generation ends up working for the younger generation. And as my brother said, my father was always his best employee. You know, he had 50 years of farming experience. So I think with the work, I think that is different because they love their work. Where I think there's a bigger challenge, candidly, is in the asset transfer area. Because the assets, by and large, especially the land, are significant and have appreciated over decades, there's a lot of sort of locked up value that potentially, if there's a sale, triggers significant capital gains taxes. And that's a huge deterrent. It's a financial deterrent for farmers to transfer those assets to the next generation. And that's a tax policy issue that I strongly believe that we need to address, because, and I won't get into the weeds here, but suffice to say that our current system, in my opinion, creates a disincentive for farmers to transfer their assets before they die. And I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that.
I would not disagree. Well, unfortunately, Jerry, we are out of time, but it's been really interesting. I hope that you will join us again on the program soon.
We'd love to. We can, you know, next time we can talk about, you know, tax issues.
I feel funny saying this, but I really look forward to that.
Me too.
For folks who want to find out more about you and your work, they can check you out at jerrycosgrove.net, or they can find you up in Albany on November 4th for the harvesting
Absolutely.
Opportunities.
Absolutely, I'll be there. Look forward to it. It's going to be a great day, so I hope folks, there's going to be a lot to learn.
Awesome. Thank you so much for tuning in
All right.
and joining us today, Jerry. Folks, you have made your way through another episode of The Farm Report. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you hear, please find us on iTunes. Leave us a review. Shoot us thoughts and suggestions. I tweet at Aaron_Fairbanks. Of course, we are a member-supported nonprofit organization. Would love to see you in our member roles. Visit us at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking, and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to this splendid table wherever you get your podcasts.